to, this is the business, tab D, Dr. Salmon.
So we have a report. I'm going to ask Mary Gable to come up. This is a report that, again, as Rose mentioned early on, we have a lot of reports required by the legislation. This is one of those reports to study something and give recommendations, but it's not the regulation. So just so that we don't get confused, this is just the results of the task force meetings, and it will turn into regulations that you will look at in December. So I want to preface this by saying that there's a lot of sincere consideration to this whole issue. And I want to say that I appreciate the committee's recommendations. And I want to be very upfront with the board and let you know that I don't agree with all of the recommendations. And so I'm just going to, not to set the task force up, but I am very concerned, and I want you to kind of view this through my lens today. I'm very concerned about taking anything out of a student's IEP that is prescriptive about this process. And I do that based on my many, many years of experience with students with disabilities, many years of personally working with students that have emotional problems, and my recent school visits where I have seen some very out-of-control children, mainly through drug addiction issues. We have about 19% of our babies now born with severe drug addictions in the hospitals. We just heard that report from the lieutenant governor last Friday when he met with the superintendents. It's very concerning to me, and not that we want to do anything to harm our children. We want to always protect our children, but I believe that a process that's documented on an IEP provides that protection. So even though you're going to hear a recommendation from the task force that says it should be removed from the IEP, I just want the board to know up front that I do not support that. And I'm hopeful that as we look at recommendations coming forward, that you will join with me in making sure that we do document very well these processes for students that are disabled on their IEPs. So with that, Mary, I hope I haven't put too many holes in the balloon for the task force, but I do feel very strongly about that. So,
certainly. Thank you.
Welcome, Mrs. Gable.
Thank you. A different topic for me to sit here. I did have to say, Dara, we feel like kind of like shakes because without Dara here, we just have been doing this so much. We had to sit next to each other, so I'm sorry.
Dara withdrawal.
Dara withdrawal, but we're here together, just not together right here. So thank you for the opportunity to give you an update on the report of the Task Force on Restraint and Seclusion. I do want to recognize Dr. Deborah Nelson, who is here, who co-chaired that with me and is truly an expert. She's sitting right here and has my back when you and if you have further questions. And secondly, we also have members of the task force who have joined us today. If you were a member of the task force, if you please stand. Just to let you know that we have some folks that have come. This was an incredible, very talented task force, and we appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you for your participation. We know that this took a lot of time, so thank you for dedicating your efforts to this.
It was an intense set of four meetings, and with that, I do want to just say at the very beginning that this is the task force, and as a result of the task force, we needed to meet the legislative requirement, which was to give the work of the task force as of October 1st, which goes to both you and the General Assembly, which we have here to the third slide, the report to the State Board and the Maryland General Assembly by October 1, which we're pleased to say that we do have that report for you. But secondly, to Dr. Salmon's point, the legislation also calls for proposed regulations that come to you, to the State Board, by December 1. We did ask for a couple of days extension since you don't generally meet in November, and that would mean that we'd have to have the regs to you by October. We just asked for a couple of more days, and we did get approval on that. So we will come back to you with recommendations for regulations where the task force will continue to meet. We also will look at the task force membership to see. We were meeting in the summer on a very close, fast timeline. We had representatives of superintendents on the task force, but we weren't able to have actual superintendents, local superintendents. And so we will invite PZAM to give us a couple of superintendents for that purpose. So what you see before you are the requirements that were in legislation 786 that the task force was to consider. And you can go through those specifically. The legislation did say the circumstances under which restraint and seclusion shall be prohibited, and that was one of the first items that the committee was to address. We also were looking at those contraindications for restraint and seclusion. For example, a child who, if they were restrained because of their physical situation, they may be hurt. So it would be very important that anyone and everyone be aware of what those contraindications would be for that particular student. Also, we needed to define certain terms that you see before you in number 3. Also, training requirements, and you'll see training requirements of looking at restraint and seclusion where there really hasn't been a set of training for seclusion. Those minimum requirements for policies and procedures, and by the way, this legislation is for local school systems, state-operated programs, and non-public schools. And then, of course, the standards for monitoring. In addition, the legislation asked us to take a look at the circumstances in physical, the types of doors and locking mechanisms. We did work with an architect to give us some background on this. In addition to looking at safety rooms, you'll see some information on doors and et cetera. So those are those items. With that, the main findings is that the current Code of Maryland framework, the main findings were, should be maintained except where recommendations are being proposed. And I do want to mention that the recommendations that are proposed are still proposed for consideration because the task force has not worked to identify what those recommendations are. So starting with the proposed recommendations, and this is the one that Dr. Salmon did refer to, but the specific language, this is physical restraint and seclusion shall be prohibited unless necessary to protect a student or others from imminent serious harm after less intrusive interventions have failed. And I don't usually read to, but this was an item that was mentioned repeatedly in our task force. What the recommendation of the task force says specifically, is that the task force recommends that whenever you need water, you don't have water. Thank you. I'm sorry. I've got two. Now we got two. Thank you. It says specifically that the task force recommends that the MSD consider revising the COMAR to eliminate language from the regulations allowing restraint or seclusion to be included on an IEP or behavior intervention plan in order to avoid overuse of these crisis-oriented responses. So that item is subject to further study, and we will continue to take a look at that since it is not a final decision of the task force.
Mary, I just want to chime in again because it just seems, I guess I just feel so strongly about this. I just don't want to let it go. It just seems to me that having to go through the process of the kind of documentation we do on our IEPs, which is extensive, you know, they've grown from 5 pages when I did them back in the 70s to, what is it now, 20-some? 20, okay. But I believe that that process and that discussion that occurs with a parent is so crucial. And to leave that out and just assume that, first of all, you won't have that communication with the parent, you won't have their knowledge base of restraint until after the fact, or seclusion. I just want to be really strong about this, and I would be more than happy to address the task force mm-hmm. at its next meeting when they're looking at these regulations, because I just find it not to work in my head, to be very honest. So I really want to stress the fact that I believe that the process of documentation is half of what you need to do before you use any kind of these, restraints or methods on our students, especially our physically vulnerable students.
Dr. Gayden?
So I just want to clarify. So the recommendation is that this cannot be included then in the IEP conversation at all or part of the conversation. And what you're saying, Dr. Salmon, is this should be a part of the overall conversations with the parents. So how would your child respond in this situation? What are their sensory issues and all of that? Why this? Can you explain the reasoning behind this first recommendation?
From the part of the task force discussion was the concern, and I think to Dr. Salmon's point, and I've had extensive conversation since with Ms. Frankowski, who I never say her name, it's Marcella, regarding the IEP. I think that. And I do want to acknowledge that there's legislation that was just passed July 1, 2017, that does talk about a parent signature. And to Dr. Salmon's point, we, as the task force, are really going to bring that up again when the task force comes together. I think the concern was that if it is in the IEP, although I truly believe that no one on the task force felt in any way that it was the first thing that someone would do, but that could it be, and I think that's a concern that we really have to address, could it be potentially overused mm-hmm. if it were in the IEP that this was something to be used? However, I think if we, as the task force, given the recommendations and the conversations that we've had, really do need to look at that IEP, look at the process, look at what's required, look at the documentation that needs to occur, and address it again with the task force to see. I mean, this is a task force that was intentional, was thoughtful, and really considered the things that they were concerned about. But at the same time, we hear the concerns, and we will take a look at that and really go through the process and really dive into what special ed does for each of these items.
Yeah, I mean, I would not expect to have a check mark on an IEP that says restraint okay or accepted by parents, but I would expect to have something along the lines of, are there particular concerns with restraint? What are they in a conversation with the parents? Because, you know, there are a few parents who understand that that might be necessary for their kids and would have recommendations on how to do that. And then there are some parents who might have knowledge that it could be extremely detrimental, and then there will be other ways to do that. So I do think that has to be part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We agree.
One of my big questions was largely legal. Do teachers feel more safety, legal safety, if there's something written into the IEP, essentially giving them like sort of clearance in advance that something like this could occur? Will they feel like they're in jeopardy if this cannot be discussed?
Well, I think as we go through some of the further recommendations, you'll see that There's a requirement for training. There's a requirement for the only certain, only those who are trained. There's a requirement that there is a discussion of what occurred and why it occurred, a discussion with the parent, a discussion to look, and if this occurs in the future, what could we do? I really would say from the group, and we did have teachers there, I did not hear a fear that was the driver of the decisions, but I do feel that those members of the task force, which you can see, I think it's on the last page or last two pages of the task force report, where these were folks that were very knowledgeable about the use of restraint, the use of seclusion.
Okay. I want to just make sure I'm pushing us along because there are a lot of things on this item. We don't need, there are no regulations for us to consider
there
today.
There are absolutely not. This is just, and you are welcome to review them and just address any questions that you might have. What we gave you were the summary of the recommendations at this point in the task force report, which is due to you. And then the recommendations will come to you in December. So we have more work to do. And for example, here is an example, just to pick and choose at least two staff, an administrator or designee, and a school-based clinician, which would be a school psychologist or a behavioral specialist, should observe for seclusion events, all of those pieces. But the recommendations are there for your review.
Great. Does anyone want to give any other thoughts, Dr. Lee?
Can you say something about how large of an issue this is? Because it doesn't, or is that why there's this recommendation to collect data?
The recommendation to collect data is in the legislation. So the legislation gives us, this is what you need to consider, this is what the task force needs to do, and you must collect data effective 18-19 based on this year. So there is a requirement for data on incidents of restraint and seclusion, what professional development was done, observation of seclusion of rooms. So we will be developing that instrument to collect that information.
But how frequent is it that this comes up, I guess is my question.
How frequently is restraint and seclusion used in schools? That's an answer I mean, I don't have data on that to say to you how often it's used.
It was conspicuous. I found myself asking the same question. Uh-huh. Is this like once a year in a county? Is it 10 times a day in a county? I just don't even have a frame of reference.
It really depends on the students and their needs. Right. And, you know, you can probably see it utilized more in a school where they're dealing just with students with behavior problems, a higher intensity kind of a facility. But it also is happening with students as young as 5. And 4 that are coming, as I said, to school with major challenges. And a lot of times it's for safety reasons. I was visiting a school last year. There were 5 adults taking care of one student to keep him in the building with his clothes on. And he was 5 years old. So, you have to kind of understand the mindset that it's not like a normal occasion, but it's there and it's in many, many situations. So we do need to get a handle on it.
So we don't have any data at all, like even countywide?
No, I think that Dr. Salmon's answer is and Marcella, she's over the, behind the poll.
We would have it through special education when it is a part of the IEP. So we would have that in direct relationship, as Dr. Salmon has shared, for students with significant behavioral and emotional disabilities and in need. But I think that's the purpose of requesting this data, so we can get a bigger picture beyond IEPs.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Any other guidance to staff before we see regulations later on this year?
I just have one question. How does this apply to our juvenile justice system? Is this going to be a COMAR regulation that is going to apply to those kids as well in during school times?
Yeah, I think it's across the board.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's an interesting conundrum, as you point out. I know that you've visited places with me and seen some of the situations that they deal with, and we're into mechanical restraints when we talk about students at juvenile services facilities. So that's going to be a whole other thing to consider.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.